This week on Potlatch, reports on Native arts activities in Alaska. This week's Potlatch consists of highlights of presentations about the Native arts programs in Alaska. These presentations occurred on May 18th in the Holiday Inn in Anchorage during the Conference on Alaskan Native Arts. Moses Wassily recorded these presentations. University of Alaska art professor Glenn Simpson told the conference, "The university now stresses instruction in Western European traditional art."
But as our program expands, I think the consensus of our faculty there is that the addition of courses such as the history of Alaska Native art are very logical directions in which to go. Programs in which we can have something that's unique, something that we're regionally, geographically equipped to specialize in, something that we can deal with, whereas the University of Iowa is not equipped to deal with. And since we have a small population, we'll be growing very slowly, we really should try to put our eggs into those areas, those baskets in which we do have some chance of doing something really special with. I remember a statement from Mike Krause, who's teaching Alaska Native languages, and he was saying, he was drawing a parallel. There were people saying, look, why don't we have a program in French? And because we have 60 students who could take a program in French and cut out the Inupiat language program because we have only 7 students there. And he said, what it comes down to is, what do you want? Do you want turkeys or do you want whooping cranes? Are you going to specialize in those things that are unique, in an area that in which you can do something unique, or are you going to just do something that every other school, every other program in the country and in the world is equipped to do? And I think, of course, the answer is that we obviously should expand into those areas that are unique to our interests and our locality.
Roger Koenig next commented that the system accounts inadequately for Alaska Native art teachers.
I'm a qualified teacher. I consider myself a teacher, but I don't have no paper that says that I'm a qualified teacher. We're tired of Native teachers who is teaching as if, you know, as instructors, but the Natives don't get paid. I'm a Native artist. I think I'm more qualified as Native than Glenn Simpson. And Glenn Simpson is a high, you know, he got a degree and everything. He gets paid more than I do. And then, with the university, we're giving credits for ivory carving. Native arts is credit. You get degrees. For ivory carving, we give out BA degrees. Way we have to do it as Native artists. I'm tired of seeing Native artists get work for somebody else and don't get paid as a professional instructor. Because a Native artist is a professional instructor. See, in the system of a program we've got, we go through system, government. We have to go through about credit-wise, ABCs, and then, you know. But Native artists, every place in this, throughout Alaska, does not get paid full amount as instructors.
Deborah Niedermeyer coordinates the Village Art Program out of the Rural Educational Affairs Office of the University of Alaska. The program is a revival of a previous program called Village Art Upgrade, which died out. She has revived the program and coordinated it for about 6 months.
The idea is to go to the villages and get people, artists in the villages, artists or craftspeople you might call them, to teach other people in the same village the things that they know. Many of the teachers that are employed through Village Art are elderly. We look for people who can teach any aspect of material culture. Not that we don't recognize dance and music as art. Again, that's a limitation that we've put on for the first year of operation, is we're going to only deal with material culture. So for Village Art purposes, we've defined art as broadly as fishnets, sculptural carving, fish hooks, fish wheels, snowshoes, sleds, and also beadwork and skin sewing, anything that's material art. We ran 4 classes this semester. The classes had official titles, but they covered a lot of topics. For instance, a beadwork class got into smoke tanning, which I thought was pretty cool. Everybody decided they knew enough about beadwork, and so they went into smoke tanning. That's great. I have a whole list of things that were taught and sponsored by Village Art and where. We also brought in 2 artists for the Festival of Native Arts this spring at the University of Alaska. One was Willie Cherepanoff, who's an Aleut carver, well, a generally talented Aleut person, and another was Billy Lincoln, who is an Eskimo Yupik carver. We did those demonstrations. Village Art is also really concerned with documenting dying forms of art through photography or film, if we can get it, if we can find the money for that. Also in keeping a record of who the native artists are, especially elderly people, just a record that, hey, this wasn't done by some Eskimo lady. This basket was made by a woman, and her name was, and perhaps here's a portrait of her. The system goes that sometimes I go out, sometimes these coordinators in all these little regional centers go out and ask people, all right, are you interested in art course? Who can teach it? Is anybody interested in teaching it? We try to make sure that the teacher is a good artist, We do get applications from people who are trying to kind of pull our leg once in a while, but we try to make sure that the person is a good artist, that the pay is $9.74 an hour. The classes run from demonstrations of 2 or 3 hours all the way up to 40 or 50 hour classes. To some extent, we provide materials for the students to learn to the extent that the budget can handle out moose hide and things like that. Sometimes we ask the people to see if they can dig that up in the village. And then the courses go. It rarely is, sit down and I sit up here and I teach you how to do this thing. It's often team taught. In Arctic Village, we had a course where the entire village was invited into the junior high school classroom, and a number of adults came, and 4 people taught mukluks, bone carving. They made some games out of caribou knuckles. Some Athabascan games. They're really neat. They're like ring toss, and you throw the caribou toe bones up and you catch them on a stick. So they made those. They made fish hooks, and they made mittens and learned skin sewing. And it was all kind of, I saw the class. It was almost like a circus, Everybody, it was like a 4-ring circus, and the people who were taking the class really liked it. One nice thing about Village Art is that we don't require anything of the teachers except that they be good artists and hopefully that they be good teachers. That's a secondary requirement. And we've gotten feedback from people who said, gee, I never had a chance to go to college or to go to high school, and yet here I am an instructor at the University of Alaska, and I think that's, I'm really proud, and people have learned and we enjoyed it. So that's what it's up to. It's in fact, so far been exclusively traditional forms, But that doesn't mean that Village Art wouldn't be open to sponsoring classes in more innovative forms if someone were to ask. We don't have the money at this point to travel instructors out to the villages, although that was done at one point. We'd like to find money to do that again.
Deborah Niedermeyer was asked how teachers are selected for the Village Art program.
First of all, to some extent, we have to trust the regional coordinator. Is this person responsible? Things like in hiring teachers, we don't assume, I mean, it's great, but we don't assume that they can read and write in English, okay? So we're trusting that the coordinators will be able to go out and ask, is this person responsible, and we'll get a truthful answer. We also ask that the coordinators take a picture of the instructor's work, if possible, and then we have a record that at least shows a photograph that somebody is, they're competent. The class runs, and we keep track of everybody who's in the class. And, of course, when you're dealing with a center which is in Fairbanks and another coordinator who is in Fort Yukon and a class running in Arctic Village, I mean, the information I get may be a little bit different than what actually happened, but we keep a list of the students. Evaluation is partly by how many people we reach and the quality of the instructor. That's about all we can do. Those were songs of tribute by Myra Robert of Vinitai. Earlier we heard the Inviting In dance song from Barrow. Both are on Folkways Records. Richard Burmeister coordinates the teaching of Native arts in the Nome Public Schools. The program operates with funds provided by the Indian Education Act and Title VII. According to Burmeister, the Indian education program has been ranked number one in the country for the past 3 years. Burmeister says he hopes graduates of his number one program in Nome will go on to study at the University of Alaska Extension Center in Arts and Crafts or to Indian Art School in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Burmeister sees his role as finding what the people want and providing it for them.
The administration in the school district is one of the few administrations that say, okay, you have a parent, board, let them make the decisions. Okay, which means our administration is very open-minded to what's going on in the program. We have a parent board, and we have a student board. The students and the parents, students meet during the school day, the parents meet once a month, They're the ones that are making the decisions, say yes, no on certain projects. They come up with the ideas. They tell me. They say, okay, we'd like to get this going. It's my job then to make sure it's functioning. The students come up and say, hey, we want to learn this. So we go ahead and we learn that. What are we dealing with? We're dealing with the native arts, crafts, and culture, cultural heritage. We have a program that's equipped to handle anything from the fine arts of printmaking, welded sculpture, ceramics, painting, wood carving, soapstone carving, anything you want to think of we can do, down to ivory carving, skin sewing, basket making, grass baskets. I'd like to get somebody in there to work with baleen baskets. We process skins, we tan skins, we build skin boats, we build kayaks, we build dog sleds. This year we're starting out our own herd and reindeer, thanks to Larry Davis, who's a reindeer herder in Nome. We deal with any aspect that the students want to learn, or the parents want to learn, or have their students learn. They bring it up, we'll work with it. Who does the teaching? Harry Kuzada, who's a man from Gamble, is the main instructor at the high school. The other one is Fred Armstrong, who is from the Buckland area. He is in dog sled construction. His expertise is there. This is what he works with. Then we go into the elementary school, and we have a Tamara Berg, who is not full native, but her family comes from the Gullivan area, and she's working with students there. And we also have one non-native at the elementary school working also, which I don't think will be any more after this year. I think she is going to be gone, and we're just going to leave Tamara there. I don't know where to begin. Well, how to tell you what we're doing. We're doing anything we can think of. We just had the representative from the Indian Education Board in out of HEW in Washington come up, and she asked me this week if I'd work with some of the other Indian Ed programs around the state that are having trouble, because our program hasn't had any trouble in the past 5 years that it's existed, really. I asked her what I could do, and she says she wanted to know how to get a good working relationship going between the parent board and the administration. And it's like pulling teeth out of an elephant and trying to get a tusk from a walrus and not kill the walrus.
If I could not be an Indian, but I could choose my clan, it's simple which I'd choose, sir, for I'd be in Ireland. Why, the way they fought the British several hundred years or more, that's the way that we fought Custer. Why, they're Indian to the core. It's hard lessons to the rulers when they hold a captive race. You cannot reach a man's heart while you're treading on his face. If I could not be an Indian, but I could choose my clan, it's simple which I'd choose, sir, for I'd be in Ireland. Take away a man's religion, give him a ball and chain. Tell him to do things your way, the results will be the same. Therefore we feel a friendship to our brothers or the sea. There's no difference in betwixt us except our enemy. If I could not be an Indian, but I could choose my clan, it's simple which I'd choose, sir, for I'd be in Ireland.
Peter LaFarge and If I Could Not Be an Indian on Folkways Records. Carl Heinmiller Jr. now directs the Haynes Indian Arts Incorporated, a nonprofit corporation founded by his father.
The number of people that work fluctuates, especially seasonally. A lot of the native people that work for us, it's about 75% native and 25% white. And most of the native people are also commercial fishermen, the ones that aren't handicapped. So they're fishing during the summer and then carving for us during the winter. And we sell the things directly out of our shop. It's a non-profit business, so from all the money from our sales goes directly back into the company. And the dance group has traveled, but like most of you either have experienced or probably will experience, the more you train somebody to become a successful artist, as soon as they have, they decide the fact that nonprofit organization isn't necessarily the best way to get by. So as soon as they become trained, they've gone out and worked in other areas. And a lot of them have become quite successful locally. Most of you probably know Nathan Jackson. He's been doing quite a good job for himself in the last number of years. And we've got a number of people working now. It fluctuates between about 8 and 12, depending on the time of the year. And this last year we started, now that there's been Indian education programs, the one in the school system in Haines was starting to grow really rapidly. And the first year that they had the program there, we were using our carvers. We were sending them to the school once a week, or five times a week, for an hour a day to teach the classes for the junior high school there, hoping that if we taught the younger students to carve, then in another 4 or 5 years when they were out of high school or they were into high school, we'd be creating a labor force for ourselves. And it worked pretty well, but it was surprising how well some of them developed. And by the time they were out of high school, they'd been working for us for a couple of years and were doing pretty well. And we lost one of them, went to Sitka, and the other one went to the Heritage Program in Ketchikan. And a couple of other carvers, Ed Caskell, went to Sitka to work as an instructor there. And we still have about 5 or 6 people working in Haines. John Hagen, you've probably seen a lot of his work around. Some of his work is in the museum here. And Cliff Thomas and a couple other people. And we've worked over the years. The dance group, we've been hoping, the costumes are very authentic in their design and things like that. And the actual performances have been getting more and more commercial over the years to deal with trying to make money from the tourists in the summer in order to carry on the artwork program in the winter of costume repairs and things. And also to travel, the group has to get more and more diversified to travel with a smaller and smaller group as costs of transportation go up, because generally the group will travel just for the fee that it costs them to travel. And so we've been hoping that the local dance group now that's been developing, the old people in the village were dancing sort of once in a while. Now they're dancing quite often. They have their own group organized, and they've been traveling some to Juneau and to Sitka to dance with the groups there. And I were hoping that it was going to happen this year, but maybe it won't happen until next year, that group will take over some sort of a regular schedule performance, because we do have a building that Alaska Indian Arts owns there that's called the Chilkat Center for the Performing Arts, and it's just a performing arts theater. It was done under grant funds in 1967 in the centennial. And we use it during the summer for performing, and then it's used for the concert series and other programs sponsored by the Arts Council over the winter. And this last year, we've been applying for grants. We've got files and files of them every year. And the biggest problem that we had was they said there were two reasons that we couldn't get funded. One of them was that we were an ongoing project, and the other one was that we hadn't been funded before. And so finally, we received a grant last year from the State Arts Council. And it was just a general operation grant, and it was made up about 25% of our budget for the last year. And so finally we've been able to exist and not lose any money for a change. Generally we'd lose money every year. My father and one of the other companies there would donate his money. The other company would donate space for our shop, and we would work in that. So basically we weren't going under, but we were going in the hole every year and spending our own money. Finally now I think we're going to make some headway. We've been trying more and more to do art in public buildings throughout since they passed the 1% law for art. There have been a lot more opportunities to do larger things, and we've placed stuff in different areas around the country. And I guess it was 3 years ago now, Dr. Masio Oka from the Little World Museum of Man came over, and they were interested. They've got a facility there in Nagoya that's a 110-acre complex, and they've been trying to build authentic replicas or purchase old houses of all the major culture groups on the Pacific Basin. Mm-hmm. So all the way up through Korea, across through most of the traditional cultures in Alaska, all the way down into South America, and then back over into Australia and things. And they were trying to obtain traditional housing or examples of traditional housing and artwork for this complex. And they came to us, and they wanted us to go to Japan and to build them a tribal house, because we had built one in Haines in 1964. And we were kind of intimidated by the fact that we knew we could do the artwork for it, but to go to Japan and do carpentry work in the face of some of the most wonderful carpenters in the world, we decided we couldn't do that. So what we did was we gave them the plans from the building that we had done, but they also got the plans from the house at Totem Bight. and they took the combination between that, the longhouse or the log houses from southeast. The ones from, say, Ketchikan south, where there was a lot more rain, had vertical walls, and in the Chilkat area, they have horizontal walls. And so they actually used our building style, or the actual dimensions of our tribal house, but which was originally taken from one of the old ones that was up in the village of Klekwan. But they built it on the style of the Totem Bite House. And so we commissioned to do all the artwork for that, and that kept us in business for about a year and a half. And they still haven't put the thing together, but if anybody happens to get to Japan, that is there. And that's, at least we consider, one of the finest examples of traditional carving on the medium, because they provided all the wood, since it was a little surprising to find out just what the Japanese interest was in Alaska. And that was that they went through 6 contracts within their own company and ended up shipping the wood that they provided us from their mill in Wrangell to Haines and back to Japan on the log ships, and it was all owned by the same corporation that owns the museum. And so eventually they sent all of the wood to that, and then we shipped it straight to Japan from there. And we've done a lot of different pieces of art around the state. We did a pole for the village of Cake. It was actually done for the state of Alaska. It was 132 feet, and it went to Expo 70 in Osaka. And then it's back, and it's in the village of Cake now. And at the time we did it, which was in 1969, it was the largest totem pole in the world. It was 132 feet tall. But since then, they've done one in Washington, and they've done one in BC, which are larger. But in the last year, we've been trying to expand the media that we work in. We do mainly silver engraving of the old style, and sculpture in wood, and we do some work in soapstone and talc. And in the last year, we've tried to expand into the graphic field, mainly because all of the handcrafted sculpture work that we do, as anyone knows, gets quite expensive. And we at first decided that the only way we could make any money dealing with the local tourist market that were coming through, especially since we get so much traffic on the road in Haines, was to make items faster. So we tried to go into a light handicraft industry and use machinery to do the rough out and things like that. And we found that basically we're trying to compete with what we didn't want to compete with, which was the junk art sales that you see so much of in Alaska. So we decided the only way to do it was to stick to what we were doing, was handcrafting things where we weren't producing anything really that was under $100 in value. And then we would try graphic arts to produce an item that was a lot cheaper. So we've taken almost all of the designs, and John Hagen and Cliff Thomas, a couple other people, do most of our designing. We've taken most of the designs that we use in our flat carving and in two-dimensional stuff in wood, and we've made them into silk screens. And so we've been doing now limited edition prints, and this will be the first season that we've had a lot of prints available for sale. And we're hoping that this will take up the $5 to $45 range and give the tourists that are interested in a good example of designing in Northwest Coast art but aren't willing to pay the price for a larger piece of sculpture.
Carl Heinmiller says that this is the first year his organization has made a profit. He looks forward to increased funding, which he said would enable Haines Indian Arts to produce Indian canoes and to create costumes for Indian dances. These are some of the various native Alaskan art programs in Southeast Alaska, the Seward Peninsula, and Interior Alaska. I'm Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening.
Potlatch came to you from KUAC in Fairbanks. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting gave some of the money to produce this program.
From the University of Alaska, this has been a KUAC production.